Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
And I'm David Goldstein. Fall temperatures have arrived in New York City. I'm sitting here. I'm wearing a flannel. I've got my jeans on. I walked my kids to school this morning and listened to autumnal music. And it's October 4th, 2021, and you are fortunate because you are listening to The Drop.
Welcome to autumn in Dropland. It feels so good to say that. This is my favorite time of year. Like you, Dave, I am wearing a flannel as we record. I took my kids to school today. I had the windows cracked so you get a little bit of chill air in there, but like a little bit of heat on in the car. I was listening to our good friend Tim Showalter's new record, In Heaven. And I was just like, the leaves are starting to change colors. You drive across like a pile of leaves on the ground and like you hear that crinkle. There's a new feeling in the air. It's the absolute best. We are on the precipice of another baseball postseason, which, as you know, as I know, as our listeners know, is like probably our favorite time of the year from a sports standpoint. And I don't know, we got a lot to get into here today. We got a great interview for you all to listen to, a lot of good music to dive into. I'm just excited to be here. Happy Monday, David. Happy Monday to you.
Happy Monday to you, Brian. I wore my Red Wing boots this morning. That's a sure sign of fall. Red Wing boots are, they're impossible to get on, but they're so damn comfortable that once they're on, I don't want to take them off. But yeah, I was full on fall man this morning. So I know we'd talked about it on the last few podcasts, but this past Tuesday, I did indeed see a Primus concert at Beacon Theater. I remember before the show, I got a beer with my buddy outside, and the table next to us is all dudes talking about when they saw Rush in the 90s, and I'm like, oh yeah, I know where these guys are going. The Primus set itself was fun, good trip down memory lane like high school, but the Rush set, in which Primus covered A Farewell to Kings, was incredibly impressive because I think they used all the same vintage gear that Rush used. And you close your eyes, and the guitar tone was exactly like Alex Lifeson, and the drummer Tim Alexander like hit every one of Neil's drum riffs like note for note. It was uncanny how much they got right.
Yeah, I peeked at your Instagram stories on it, and it was, I want to say it was on par for me with if the War on Drugs decided to cover, say, like Dylan's Infidels or U2's The Joshua Tree, where it was just like a meeting of bands I absolutely love in a setting that, like, I don't know, it's just perfect. And I think it's really fascinating. It's such a cool testament to how incredible music is that you have these artists that are touring on their own laurels, and yet they decide to dedicate so much time and energy to covering an album and covering the aesthetics of an album. What an incredible thing, man. Like, what a great like representation of what music can do and what music can be.
Yeah, I mean, Primus, I know, like, Geddy Lee was always a huge, huge influence on Les Claypool, and there's a lot of crossover between those fan bases. There were more Rush shirts than Primus shirts in the audience, so it made sense. It was, you know, I think it was set in motion after Neil Peart died in early 2020, and it was a very well-done tribute. I'm glad I went.
Well, beyond that, there was we had kind of like a lot of cultural fodder for that. That's like right up our alley over the last couple of days. There was a new trailer that dropped for my favorite director for his new movie, Paul Thomas Anderson. I believe he's very high up there for you, if not your favorite. Licorice Pizza, starring Alana Haim and is it Charlie Hoffman? Cooper Hoffman.
Yeah, Cooper Hoffman.
Right. Philip Seymour Hoffman's son. This looks incredible.
Yeah, this is basically P.T. Anderson kind of getting into my dome and saying, what can I do to make Dave really, really, really excited for this movie? Why don't we take one of the Haim sisters and Philip Seymour Hoffman's son and put them in like a Cameron Crowe-style trailer soundtrack to a David Bowie classic? Yeah, that'll work. I mean, yeah, P.T. Anderson, he's the best director America's got going. I make a point to see every one of his movies opening weekend.
Yeah, this looks like a Wes Anderson almost, just in like its tale of high school love. And, you know, you've got theater in there. You've got love lost. You've got adults meddling in kids' businesses. And then you've got David Bowie underscoring it. It's got like a fusion of Cameron Crowe, Wes Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson. I can't wait for it. Nonetheless, it looks incredible.
So earlier, you just mentioned how when you were taking your kids to school, you were listening to the new Strand of Oaks record from our good buddy Tim Showalter. I have got to listen to it twice this morning, walking my daughter to daycare, and I got to listen to it again when I got home. And twice through, it appears to be quite an achievement. Sonically kind of pulls Bark off the same tree as his last record, Eraserland, did, except there's more of it. He's taken the attack and he's kind of sharpened it, and he's added all the reverb and all the pathos you want from a Strand of Oaks record, and I'm really excited to dive into it some more, and hopefully in the coming weeks we can get him on the podcast to talk about.
Yeah, this record, I'm about halfway through it as of time of recording. It just like blew me away. Reverb soaked. The third song on the album, Hurry.
Ooh.
Dave texted me right first thing when I woke up. I saw this, that this like might be the archetypal Strand of Oaks song, and I couldn't agree more. Thematically, from a lyrical standpoint, I feel like Tim has tapped into something that like speaks more honestly and truthfully about who he is and his view on the world in a really just like naked and vulnerable way. And then the music is just like fucking epic.
I think that song starts out with a nod to Neil Young's Albuquerque.
Ah, that's another reason why I loved it. Yeah, that's a good observation.
Yeah, that's definitely the type of Easter egg he would drop.
I also want to give a huge shout out to Jimmy and Stan, which I believe he wrote about his cats who passed away during quarantine or possibly right before quarantine, and the song is about him imagining them going to shows in heaven. And it seems as though the entire theme of the album is wrapped up in this song about, like, you know, these animals and these beings and these people and all this death that's around us right now, and like imagining what people are doing in heaven and how you wish you could be there, but you also wish that they are just like happy and stoked on life. And we put our dog of 13 years down earlier this summer, and I was listening to the song when I was driving around and just like smiling and crying, and like he just nails the vibe of like, I'm so sad, but I'm so thankful for the years that you gave me, but I wish that we could be hanging out. But also like the kind of human element that we ascribe to our animals, like our dog was with us before we ever had kids, and was like, you know, for us, for my wife and I, like our dog was, you know, he was our best friend. He was our companion. And we had like, you know, made up lives for him in our head because we thought about him way too much. And Tim just nails that vibe of saying goodbye to those companions. So I'm really excited to finish the record. And I feel like it's gonna be one of those records that like I just throw on again. I'm gonna have my first bonfire in my backyard of the season. And I know that it's gonna be blasting while I'm having the fire. So really, really great stuff, Tim. And we'd love to talk with you a little bit more about it.
So I think when this is going to air on Monday, there will have been, we're recording on a Friday. It's going to come out on Monday. And with the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in between, those will have been the last three Trey Anastasio Band shows of what's been quite an interesting tour. You can almost say this is like a Trey Anastasio Band Survivor edition. That's kind of dark, maybe, but
yeah. I think you're just like, you're pushing forth the vibe and the sense of humor that Trey has had about this. Like,
yes,
hearing him, yes, in between songs, especially when he gets the acoustic guitar out, and you know, just talking about like, hey man, this is how we have to tour in 2021 and we're just making it work. You know, I get the sense that Russ and Jen are doing well, that James Treatment is going well. I don't think that Trey would be joking around about this stuff if any of them were in really bad ways.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that this again, you know, I don't want to keep doing this, but I think we kind of have to. Like, this is a public service announcement for the vaccines. Like, they are out on tour. They are playing to packed rooms. They're playing outdoors. They're playing indoors. They're traveling. They're dealing with roadies. They're dealing with people who work at the venues, all these different people that they have to come into contact with, no matter how careful they are, no matter how much they're following and abiding by health restrictions. But the virus is still out there and it still can get to you. But the benefit of the vaccines appears to be that even though two members of Trey's band were infected, they seem to be doing okay. I hope that holds through Monday. That all said, you know, this tour has kind of run in like three different courses, where we had this really great start to the tour with the full band. And to me, it was the most interesting tab we'd heard in years.
Yeah, totally.
And then we lose the horn section and we get this incredible show on Sunday that features a 20-minute MoMA dance and really hear like Dezron come out into his own. And then Russ tests positive, and so Trey plays an acoustic show. And we think, okay, it's just going to be an acoustic tour. And like, acoustic Trey has been great the last 5 or 6 years. He brings his pedals out there. He tells really cool stories. But then fucking John Fishman joins him. Oh my God. And the show, as we're recording, the only show we've heard with Fishman was the Pittsburgh show. And it was stunning. It was a 4-song first set. There were like multiple 20-plus-minute long songs. It was incredible.
It's some serious cognitive dissonance, because you're listening to it and you're like, okay, that's definitely Fishman on the drums, but there's congas under it and Ciro's a whistle, and that's definitely not Page and definitely not Mike on bass. So what's going on here? I've heard people call it like JFAT, as in like John Fishman's almost tab. I may have texted some friends the gif of like the Black Knight from Monty Python, the Holy Grail, saying, "'Tis only a flesh wound, come back." But it's pretty great. I mean,
it is.
I can't remember the last time I would wake myself up. Well, not wake myself up, but I'm 42 years old. Sometimes I gotta use the bathroom at 2 o'clock in the morning and then do that, and then look on my phone to see the tab set list. But yeah, it's totally fascinating, and it portends well for fall tour, and it's a really interesting, great time to be a Trey slash Fish fan.
Yeah, our mutual friend Josh Carver at NOLA Sox, who I think gets an obligatory shout out in every single show. He and I were texting each other the last couple of nights as like tour was coming through, as set lists were appearing, because the coverage of Tab is very different from the coverage of Fish. You don't have, you know, Scott Marks tweeting every single song. You don't have people there who are tweeting updates. So like, it's few and far between until you see something that comes up on Live Fish. But you know, we got notification, I think all three of us, on what was that, Wednesday night, that there was a four song first set.
Right.
And Josh and I were texting back and forth with each other, being like, how many times have you refreshed the Live Fish app? How many times have you refreshed the Live Fish? And I was just like, I'm finishing up the White Lotus, and I was just like sitting there like pulling down on my phone screen just over and over again, like, come on, please appear. And finally it did. And I was like, oh my God, here we go.
Fish shows, the show will go up like 20 minutes after the show ends. With Tab, it's more like 2.5 hours.
Right. But it was good. I loved the 46 days from Pittsburgh, and I'm really excited to hear whatever we got this past weekend. We will probably be talking about it here in the coming days and weeks. But all this has piqued my interest, and I've gone back and I'm listening currently through the 2003 Tab Tour. I'm out on the Warfield shows right now, where the first night was it the first night? I don't know. Yeah, I think one of the nights of the Warfield, I haven't gotten there yet. Santana sits in for the entire second set. And there's like a 30-minute Mr. Completely, John the Revelator, I think The Way I Feel. It's an amazing, amazing second set. I remember listening to it a ton in college. But I'm making a playlist right now of like my favorite moments. It's that 2003 summer tour. You kind of got part of the tightness of the 2001 summer tour, part of the looseness of the 2002 tours, a lot of these new songs that would go on to be on both Fish's Undermined as well as Shine, as well as kind of, you know, be the last bastion of classic, original, pre-Fish breakup Tab songs that like live and breathe within, you know, the Tab universe. So I've really been enjoying that, and I'll share a playlist once I'm done with that. But good stuff on the Tab lens. Any other concert announcements come up?
Yeah, the last bit of piping hot breaking news. Actually, this kind of just broke about an hour before we started recording this. LCD Sound System, James Murphy's merry band of hipster groove merchants, they just announced that they're going to be playing 20 shows at Brooklyn Steel in Williamsburg neighborhood in New York City, where I am. 20 shows through the end of November and December that I think go on sale next week. There's pre-sale, to which I say, okay, that's interesting. I think Brooklyn Steel, that's a venue, I think it holds about 1,800 people. I'd be very curious to know if there's the demand that by the time you get the shows 15 and 16, they just aren't falling off trees. But we'll see. I'd also be curious to see if there's going to be like a surprise album drop, because Murphy's had a bunch of time in quarantine to do such a thing, and that's LCD Sound System in the studio is kind of just him. But I don't know. I don't necessarily feel compelled to go, but that's a show that if a buddy has a ticket, I might be like, all right.
I feel like a person's like definitive years of establishing like what music and culture feels like to them are 17 to 25.
Okay. Yeah.
And as someone who experienced 17 to 25 between 2002 and 2010, I associate LCD Sound System with that Brooklyn revival in the aughts. And to me, this is very, very fitting. And this feels nostalgic in the best way, but also like, I loved American Dream. I thought that was potentially the best LCD Sound System record. I know Sound of Silver is amazing. You've got Someone Great, you've got All My Friends, everything else on that record is absolutely perfect. But American Dream took this idea of what LCD Sound System could be and like made it middle-aged and very serious, and updated it with everything going on in America in 2016, 2017, that period in time of conflict. I am excited about this. I will not be coming to the shows. probably part of your rationale for why some of these would be dropping off. I would definitely be doing this for 20 Nights of Fish at MSG. We'll probably not be doing this for 20 Nights of LCD Sound System, but hey, maybe they'll do some live streams. And I think you're right. And I will also say 2019, they put out a live recording from, I believe, Electric Ladyland.
Yeah.
And I loved that. I was a huge, huge fan of that release. So I'm excited for it. I think it's a good thing.
For me, it's interesting because, like you said, between like 17 and 25, but I moved to the city, New York City, in 2001. So I read the Lizzie Goodman book, Meet Me in the Bathroom. That's kind of like a travelogue of my life. I mean, I wasn't doing blow at the darkroom at 3 o'clock in the morning because I was in law school studying. But in terms of like going to early LCD Sound System shows, hearing James Murphy DJ and seeing him out at like the same clubs and parties I was at, I kind of have a little different take on it. But certainly, I mean, I think a lot of the people going to LCD shows nowadays are, you know, people in like their 20s and teens that didn't get to see the band on their first time around. Kind of like when I saw the Pixies in 2004, I was like extremely excited to go to those shows because I was too young to see them back in 1991. So I think you're going to be getting a lot of the crowd at these shows. But, you know, it's a force for good, ultimately. It's kind of like a Brooklyn is back type thing. But I'll be very curious to see where demand is. I mean, I don't know. I don't think they changed up the set list show to show that much at all. Maybe there was like a little bit of variation, but it's not like a Baker's Dozen type, you know, thing like that.
Right. I think that you're expecting a band that hones in on a sound and may have a new album in the works, so you may get some new songs in there. I mean, I think it's an interesting point you make about the Pixies, because like if someone is 25 years old here in 2021, they were born in 1996. Like the experience of the first movement of LCD Sound System was when they were a kid. I'm sure that they've gotten into LCD Sound System over the last, you know, decade or so. And, you know, it's an interesting idea, like the regurgitation that LCD Sound System represented, where they basically took post-punk, DIY, you know, early technology from the 1980s and kind of amalgamated it into this really infectious sound. And now 20 years later, that in and of itself is a nostalgic idea, like that amalgamated sound. It's just, it's kind of wild, but I'm excited for it. And I hope that there's a new record in the works. But as we noted at the top of the episode, it is October. Quickly, before we jump into the big discussion of the week, what is going on in the baseball world? We are on the precipice of the playoffs. Both of our teams are out of it and have been out of it for, in your case, less than my team has, but still a significant amount of time in baseball timeline. What's happening as you're we're here at the start of the playoffs?
Well, right now, I mean, the Mets have entered into and they've been in it for some time. They're meaningless, albeit intermittently fun, baseball phase. Like earlier in the week, they had Jerry Seinfeld in the booth for two innings, which was a lot of fun. He's a huge Mets fan. Last night, Francisco Lindor hit a grand slam. Pete Alonso had two home runs. You know, it's good that these guys get to pad their stats going into the offseason. But really, the big action, obviously, at this point is on the American League wildcard race, which is super tight and super interesting. I'm pulling for the Mariners because that would be an amazing story, because the Mariners are kind of like New York Mets West in terms of their eternal underdog status, as well as the fact that there's a lot of Mariners right now that were Mets in like 2018 and 2019, and they're having career years. So that's kind of fun for me to watch at the moment.
Yeah, I'm pulling for the Mariners as well. At this point on release date, we should know where things fall. Right now, when we're recording, there is currently a tie between the Mariners and the Red Sox for the second wild card. The Blue Jays need to sweep the Orioles to have any chance of being in the playoffs. I mean, there's a chance that as of time of release, there could be a lot happening in terms of like single elimination baseball games, which would be a ton of fun. I don't expect that to happen. It never fully happens the way that we want it to. But there's definitely like a lot of intrigue right now with baseball. All I will say is I am pulling right now just based on where the playoffs are for a Giants, either Red Sox or White Sox World Series. I think that that would be really fun. Some good cities in play. You get California, you get either the East Coast or the Midwest. Yankees, I would be happy only because of Anthony Rizzo. But and Dodgers, I do love this Dodgers team, but there's not a lot in the NL that I really want to see advance. I have no interest in the Cardinals having a big run. I have zero interest in the Braves having a big run. You know, it's just, it's, if we end up with an Astros Braves World Series, it might be the first time I don't watch the World Series since 2003, which fucked the Florida Marlins.
Yeah. F the Florida Marlins. F the St. Louis Cardinals. Yeah, I don't know. I think it'd be fun to see the Seattle Mariners go on an improbable run, and hell for New York Mets fans is living in New York City whenever the Yankees are playing well, so I don't really want to see that happen. But, you know, as always, it's October baseball at this time is always enjoyable if you're a baseball fan, irrespective if your team is in it. So, at this point, I want to transition to our larger discussion. So, if you recall, on our last podcast, we had showcased Daniel Donato's Lost Highway podcast that I had been listening to. So, we decided just to bring Daniel Donato on the podcast because he's going to talk about his excellent podcast. We also, he and his band just put out a new record called Cosmic Country and Western Songs. It's 8 songs and 33 minutes. And he is 26 years old. He's a fantastic Telecaster player. He's one of the most in-demand Telecaster players in Nashville right now. And he's a fascinating guy. He's a great conversationalist. He's one of those dudes that you just talk to him once, you feel like you've known him your entire life. And it was a pure joy getting to talk to him for about 25 minutes yesterday. So we are going to listen to that right now. Here's a conversation I had with Daniel Donato. Daniel, tell me, where are you today? You're at home, right?
Yeah, I'm in Nashville, a little bit south of Nashville, of all the action.
Is that still Nashville? Is that like Franklin or where?
Yeah, it's still Nashville. It's not quite okay. Franklin. Still Davidson County. Williamson County is where I grew up, and that's where I want to end up, too. It's a really kind of a magical area.
We were, our last podcast, Beyond the Pond, in 2019, kind of as a 40th birthday celebration for me of sorts, we recorded a podcast at Vinyl Tap in East Nashville.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Love that
place. Like, sat outside Vinyl Tap for about 3 hours and just drank pint after pint of, I want to say, Bearded Iris Homestyle.
Oh, okay. Cool.
At the end of it, we were crying, but it was awesome. We love Nashville, especially East Nashville.
East Nashville, absolutely. That has to be the more culturally integrated part of town, if you're referring to like different styles of entertainment and aesthetic, even architecture. There's Little Hollywood in East Nashville, which has just, you know, amazing modern homes, and there's old ranch villas, and it is an interesting part of town. And it's also the part of town that's very much so growing extremely fast. And it's that classic conundrum that David Byrne refers to in his book How Music Works, where, you know, cities grow and therefore the property grows, and then all the artists have to leave, and they just kind of have the diaspora either eastward, westward, and that's happening now in East Nashville. It's very fascinating to see kind of that life cycle happen before my very own eyes in my hometown.
So part of the reasons we have you on today is you're a fellow Osiris podcaster. I've been binging episodes of The Lost Highway with Daniel Donato, and I like it because you've got like an enthusiasm for your guests that can't be faked.
I'm really bad at faking enthusiasm. Yeah, I'm really, I'm not good at it. I'll work really hard though at the things that I am enthusiastic about. And I hope that those are the things that just work out, take care of the work and the work works for you kind of a concept.
Absolutely.
And there's just so, you know, there's a rule that, or maybe it's more of a philosophy. It's like, I really try to be as present as I can with anyone I speak to and think that there's something I can learn from them. I'm not always accurate in that trying, but the podcast, I certainly try, and I learn so much from talking to people. It's literally freaky.
If you could give a brief description of the podcast, what would you say? Like, for me, yeah, it's just really interesting conversations with luminaries from like the cosmic country world and the extended Fish and Grateful Dead world.
Yeah, I love that. And my whole thing, the things that I always bring to the table best are like more abstract and artistic communication. So it's the way that I'm viewing the Lost Highway is that it's kind of metaphorical to life, is that we're all kind of on this Lost Highway. And there's things that you can learn along the way by people that are also on the ride with you. And so in Cosmic Country is kind of this thing I'm discovering is, it's like it's my life. And so I can talk to people, you know, about NFTs, and that's also bleeding into what Cosmic Country is. I can talk to people who have started, you know, 8 businesses here in Nashville and worked for Johnny Cash for like 30 years, because that's part of what Cosmic Country is too. So it's kind of talking to people from all walks of life and taking lessons that they've learned and giving it to the listener. As simple as that.
Like, I know you did an interview, I think last season, with our buddy Jesse Jarnow, we had on the podcast a while back.
Yeah, I love your episode with Jesse. I think Jesse's very brilliant in the way that he's able to take so much data and make and bleed it into a message that's so easy to consume. That's so far, he takes these points that are so far and few between. He is wild. Specifically, the episode of the Friend of the Devil, good old Grateful Dead cast. That freaked me out. That whole episode, that was unreal.
Yeah. People out there in the dropboard are looking for a good place to start with Daniel's podcast. Certainly, the Jesse episode was great. The recent episode I liked a lot with Vincent Neil Emerson, because his new album is awesome.
Yeah, he's a cool cat, man. His mind is wild. He's kind of like John Prine, or more like Blaze Foley than he is John Prine, really. Yeah, he's wild. Yeah, that's the thing too. Is on my podcast, you'll hear people that, you know, are Jesse Jarnow, and then you'll hear Americana artists. You know, you'll hear anything that is simply inspiring. I'm not trying to stick to one genre or be inclusive of one kind of people. I like breaking these personal borders that we all make for each other that aren't very necessary.
Do you have Peter from Goose on like an episode?
I did have Peter on Spock on for an episode, and I absolutely see now how his brilliance is able to, you know, be applied to Goose after talking to him. Because I went in there, I usually don't go in with a lot of questions or intention. But with Peter, I had questions. I wanted to know what his deal was and what his intention was. And because they execute at this level that is just so admirable to me. Like, it's otherworldly. It's like Fish 1.0. But not. It's not like the magnetism and the phenomenology. It's kind
of got that band has it has like the intangible, right? That can really elevate like that type of jam band to like a larger audience. Like, you can tell they're still growing, which is why it's really fun to watch it happen in like real time.
So. And that's the thing too. It's like, I think I had this realization of more of an idea, but it's like Fish is still growing. They had 35,000 people at Atlantic City this year, so it's like, you know, this game that we tell people, like here in Nashville, like I've been told a lot of stories growing up here in town that, you know, kind of narrowed my perception. I think you kind of get told that you arrive at a certain place in your career and that you stop growing. But then it's like, it's not true. It's even like the Grateful, like Dead & Co. is growing. It's like everyone's still, you never stop growing if you get trucking, like on the, you know, it takes a while to pick a place to go, you know, but and keep trucking on. But you keep going.
Fish is amazing. In the most recent tour, it was just, there's so much goodness and it keeps changing. And I mean, I think they're getting better, which is kind of crazy because they've been around for like almost 38 years at this point.
Yeah, they're better in certain ways. I have friends that have been seeing them since 91. You know what I mean? That's before I was born. And it's like, you know, Trey can't do what he used to do, that kind of a thing. And it's like, you know, I don't know if it's as linear as a better and not better thing. I think it's like a, I think it's like how a tree grows. You know what I mean? Like that tree's, like it's that. Just, that's it's great. Just growing, right? It's like, you never look up, go up to a tree and be like, that's wrong. You know, like that didn't grow right. You know, but it's like the most beautiful part of nature is that it can, you know, and the vascularity of a tree is interesting. I was looking at a photo of a tree that got struck by lightning. It kind of took like the sheath of wood, of the initial wood that was on it, and it just showed like the vascularity of the tree. On this guy's Instagram, Robert Edward Grant, who's like a ancient geometry illustrator. And I cannot tell you, David, how crazy the vascular makeup of this tree was. It was just infinitely complex with in twirling and going left and right, up and down, and meshing with each other. It was like, nature is so a not straight thing, and we as humans try to make like the straightest things possible.
That's a very good description of the fish trying to stage of experience, especially this week when there's been members of the Tab band that have been dropping off. So it was like, okay, we'll just bring in giant fish. We'll keep playing.
I'm so excited. That to me is like what you do with your intuition, I think, says like everything or a lot of things. And he brought in John Fishman. It's like, of course he brought in John Fishman. Not for a Ghost of the Forest thing, but just like, of course he did, you know? It's,
right.
I love that.
I listened to like the first 35 minutes of last night's show already, and I'm just excited to listen to it again. It's different. It's fish, but not. But if I could just transition briefly, even before you had a podcast, I guess you were like a hell of a Telecaster player.
Yeah, I love playing a tele, man. I do. It's my favorite guitar.
And you got, I think we're recording this on September 30th. You just put out like a new record, correct?
The new record came out today, and okay. Fortunately through the team over at Osiris Media too, like me talking through each song on the Lost Highway, my podcast, that episode is out today too.
Oh, no, awesome. Nice.
Yeah, okay. Just kind of reacting and doing that whole thing like, oh, I didn't know, I forgot about this acoustic guitar, or here's the story behind this drum fill and why we kept that in there, and giving context, giving as much data as possible to those who want to hear it.
So if I'm correct, the album is kind of, it's a tribute to the Don Kelly band from Robert's Western World.
Right. Yeah. If I ever did have like an analogous place that was Nectar's, a place in which I was able to blossom freely, right? Nectar's is almost like acid test in some way. Also, it sounds a little bit more innocent and less like less otherworldly. And Robert certainly was, because it's pretty much just like the greatest honky tonk in the world. It's right. 33 feet away from the Ryman. So it has like this radiation poisoning of country music greatness. And there was one band that played there from 1996 to 2020. And it was a band called the Don Kelly Band. And they had pretty much like the archetypal Nashville gunslinger. Everyone who ever was one played in that band. And I got to play in that band when I was like 16 to when I was like 20. And I played almost 500 shows with them. And it was an experience that I carry with me and play in every note that I ever pick or sing.
Kind of like a finishing school for Telecaster players in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a good metaphor.
I think I saw them. I've been to Robert's twice. Once, the last time I was there was November of 2017. I went there at like 6 o'clock. I think it was like on a Thursday night. I'm pretty sure it was them.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. They played Wednesday through Sunday.
Okay.
4 hours a night.
I remember at that show going back to the bar to get a drink and thinking it was going to be like New York City prices. So I'm like, I'll just get a can of PBR. And it was like $2. I'm like, oh, fuck, for $2, I'll buy one for my neighbor. I just saw this guy at the bar. I said, what are you drinking? I bought him a can of PBR. I said, cheers. Watched the Don Kelly Band. It was awesome.
Oh, my gosh. She said that there's a fascinating thing that I love about Roberts that I'm realizing I love about music is that certain music has transportational qualities, right? And then also the environment in which you're in, set and setting rather. And Roberts has this transportational quality where you can't help but kind of just be transitioned rather into a time that is not now. You're in this older, more simple world.
Yes.
And the music therefore is framed differently and can be received differently. And so honky tonk and country music can really be like an inclusive, fun party. It doesn't need to be, you know, perhaps the kind of country music that a lot of people might not identify with. on a cultural level. It's just not who they are. But this kind of music, like, it's almost, it's really universal. It's like bluegrass. It's like you can't help but just kind of move your head and love the message.
Like, when I was at Roberts, I was just thinking, all these people in here, maybe I don't share their politics or their background, but all that matters is we're all drinking PBR watching this incredible honky-tonk band, and everyone here is my friend right now, and that's, if we could all get together and listen to Don Kelly, we probably realize we have a hell of a lot more in common.
Yeah, you know, there was a fascinating thing I heard recently from a 1976 interview with Jerry Garcia. Recently, this year, 2 months ago or so. And I've been keeping in my mind where it's Jerry was talking about politics and music. They asked him a question about his political views, and he wouldn't answer it. And he goes, like, we're here to talk about music, you know, and I'm not trying to mix the worldly with the unworldly. It's something along those lines. And it's like, that to me is so true. It's like, mixing music with, you know, political views, I never see it work out very well unless it's like in the form of song, right. You know, and it's like, then it's just like an artistic statement, but it's like, you're kind of like mixing something so worldly and man-made with something that is so not made, something that is just from like the benevolence of the universe.
Absolutely. I mean, I've heard the record. I like that it's really well produced. You got the drums, especially like the first song, the single "Why You Been Gone So Long." It's got that like snappy, almost like Tom Petty. You don't know how it feels, like kick to it.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's driving. It's really. I appreciate records that people took the time to make them sound good.
Oh, so yeah. You know what's funny too, David. This is a good point. I was talking about this on the Lost Highway. Now is the time, like when the songs go out in the world and they affect people, and then people can tell me what they think about it. And that is always where the exponential amount of angles of perception of music start to come alive. Where it's like, I would never have thought that it was like a Wildflowers era Petty sound, but then now I see it, and it's like totally. I totally see that, and I love it. I do, and it's like that's also my favorite era of Tom Petty. You know, it's like. That's what's so cool about music is it is a realm in which there is no right or wrong. It's also one of the freaking scariest things about it, too.
It's got a good, I enjoyed the jamminess, the jammy version of Ghost Riders in the Sky.
Yeah.
Which is such a lineage for that song, been covered like this way and that way since like the 40s.
Yeah.
That was cool. It was just so good. And I like the fact that it was like 33 minutes.
Yep.
You just put it on and put it on again. So I'm looking forward to like really being able to dive into that. But I think I heard the Past Fish Nashville shows. Were those your first ones that you got to attend?
Yeah, I attended Pelham, Alabama, and then I did two nights in Alpharetta, and then I did two nights in Nashville. And then we played after night one in Nashville.
Oh, so you saw like five shows?
Saw five shows.
Oh, fuck yeah. Okay.
I saw, yeah, and each one was very special. Pelham was especially special, and then night two in Nashville was special. Night one in Nashville was fun. We were playing down at Roberts afterwards, and Mike Gordon actually came.
Oh, nice.
Which I, you know, that was weird because I went in right into Rocky Top when he walked in. I had to. The band, we stopped the song. I was like, one, two, three. We got to go right in. He liked it. He stayed for a while. I was surprised. It was like people were like fucking with him too. They were like talking to him, taking pictures, and I was surprised he stayed. It was like a really busy night. But he just came up to the front of the stage and just eyed my bass player, because in Cosmic Country we play some songs like an upright bass, kind of like you'll see Billy Strings with an upright bass, you know. So you kind of get into this old Americana world of string songs. And but then we also go electric, and so he saw my bass player go to upright, and I saw that catch his eye, and I was so inspired by the fact that he is going out and, like, you know, following inspiration and being inspired by music after playing Ascend Amphitheater. You know, it's the coolest thing.
No, the second night of that Nashville run, night one is okay, night two is out of this world. That was like a top five show of the tour.
The Mister completely into Birds of a Feather into Bathtub, like into Space Odyssey was like. That was that sequence there, was like the second half of my life, or the second part. Like, truly, that was the revelatory peak of the 5 days for me, was those songs. Why do you say night two was better?
Night one, to me, seemed a little bit listless. Like, yeah. They don't always connect. When you take the type of risks on stage that that band does, when they connect, when everyone's on the same page, it's out of this world, which was the second set of the second night of Nashville. It just flowed like one. When I hear that show, I think of The Color Brown, because it's like big. And to me, that kind of felt like a big mud monster, kind of like going like every which way. When wow. They go right into the bathtub gin, and
oh.
That's like Paige is playing like Wurlitzer during the bathtub gin, which she doesn't normally do. And I was just, yeah, that set, and then the extra, like the half hour, 34 minute tweezer from Alpharetta, which kind of sounds like 70s Stevie Wonder at the end of it, like the Moog.
Yeah. It's
out of this world.
You know, we got a good, this was one that I thought, I loved The Sand too, as well, from Alpharetta.
Yes.
That was my first time being able to see Sand live, and that song I'm particularly interested in. Just as you know, it's like, how do you take one chord and just, you know, you don't change, you do one chord. It's like, that to me is everything. The simplicity, yes. Yeah.
So sometimes it modulates, but at this heart, it's just the one bass line that, like, Tony Markelis, rest in peace, came up with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then that song can just, you can just ride it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a really good version. I mean, I thought, for me, my favorite night of the tour is probably the first night at Deer Creek, which I think is one of the best two-set shows. That, and then the first night of Shoreline with the big Soul Planet in the second set.
I've heard mixed emotions on that Soul Planet, and no one's in the middle. They're either like, I love that 47-minute Soul Planet. Or the
other, awesome.
Right, and so yeah. I love it. And then, you know, my friends are like, it never hit. And it's like, that's fine, too. That's fine, too, you know.
I listen to that at the gym, and I just leave thinking I could, like, fly over a building.
Whoa, that is, yeah, I would love to, I have a couple, this coming out on the Lost Highway 2, are some neuroscientist friends of mine who love fish. And yeah. One thing that we really want to do is, like, somehow go to a fish show, and then afterwards, take a recording of how you feel, you know, substances and all that you've consumed, and then have a sober recollection of the show, and then try to maybe observe, like, on a chemical level what's happening. Because I have to think that it's a very fascinating stew that's going on in the brain when you're at a fish show. They're probably really just like changing your brain like a Rubik's Cube. That's what absolutely. I felt like. Yeah.
Do you have any tour dates lined up for the new record?
We do. Not a huge one. Not a huge amount of dates. We like had one planned, and then logistically everything got so weird in a matter of like 10 days. Because of what was going on with the Delta variant. So this will now be two records that we've put out where we actually didn't have, like, supporting tours to go with, but we put them out during weird times. But the biggest thing we have coming up that I'm excited about is Widespread Panic was kind enough to offer us the opportunity to open shows for them in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
So that's going to be exciting. And then we just have other headlining Cosmic Country dates. Coming out, and I'll be going west, northwest, or northeast and southeast.
Widespread in Milwaukee. Is those in theaters, or those got to be outdoors?
Those are outdoors.
Okay.
Yeah. And the whole outdoor dynamic of playing versus the indoor dynamic is a very fascinating one to riff on as well.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I don't know. There's rumors that Fish's upcoming fall tour is going to move to outdoors. I don't know. I have no idea what's going to go on. With that, I assume it's going forward at this point, but it will be fascinating to see. Like, I saw a Tranastasio band before band members started to go down outdoors in New Haven, Connecticut a few weeks ago. That was just a gorgeous, gorgeous fall night. That was great.
Yeah.
But anyway, I would tell everyone out in the drop, please listen to The Lost Highway with Daniel Donato. Check out his new record. It's really great stuff, and as you've heard, he's a fantastic conversationalist. I really enjoyed doing this.
Thanks.
So, thanks for coming on, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Cool. Right on, man. My pleasure, David.
All right. That was such a fantastic interview, Dave. Like, when I was putting that together within the episode, I like felt like I was levitating like 3 or 4 feet off the ground. Donato has just like such like optimism and curiosity and intrigue about him, like just in the way he speaks and the way he approaches the world and the way that he thinks about music. Like that analogy that he made to fish in 2021 as being a tree.
Yeah, that blew my mind. That was awesome.
Like, what a way to rethink fish. Like, you never looked at a tree and been like, that's not what it should look like. It shouldn't have grown that way. Like, no, that's just what happened. That's where it is. And it makes me think I have this box elder in my backyard, this like just like sprawling tree that like, it looks like a tree that would be in like a witch's house. And I love it so much. There's so much to look at. And it's just like, we just tore down our back patio literally so that we could sit on a porch and look up at this tree at night. And it just fascinates me. So, I got so much out of that. I feel like we need to make another trip to Nashville to eat at the Redheaded Stranger and to go see Donato play a show.
Yeah, pretty I forgot awesome. To ask him about Redheaded Stranger. But yeah, if he's listening to this right now, go to the Redheaded Stranger in East Nashville, get some breakfast tacos, get your hash chili cheeseburger, and make the world a better place. Because, you know.
Tell Brian Weaver that Fish sent you.
Yes.
That will make his day. Yes. So with that, we're going to jump into the final segments of this week's show, which is always a segment on new records, as well as classic albums. And those of you who have been listening keenly on and weekly to The Drop know that we've been jumping back in time 5 years at a time, and we are now in the mid-1960s. Before we get to the mid-1960s, though, new albums, lots of new music coming out. This is kind of starting to be that time of year where you have to start assessing what were my favorite records of the year, kind of listening back to things that you heard maybe once or twice, kind of start to see where things fall on your larger list. But David, what is your new record that you want to recommend here this week?
I am going to recommend an album by a Louisville, Kentucky-based guitarist, singer-songwriter, Nathan Salzberg. And he has a new record, I think it came out at the end of August, called Psalms. And the psalms in question are Hebrew psalms. And this album is interesting because in order to write it, I believe what he did was sort of go through a selection of Hebrew prayers, both in English and in Hebrew, and he kind of picked out the ones that he found most interesting, and he sings the album in Hebrew. I think he had a Reformed Jewish upbringing in Louisville, Kentucky, and kind of saw this record as a way of sort of reimagining or reconnecting with his Jewish roots. And in so doing, he has a backing band that consists of Spencer Tweedy on drums, his partner Joan Shelley on backing vocals, plus Will Oldham and James Elkington, who also co-produces. It's just a beautiful, transporting record. I mean, I think he and I are pretty similar in age. I grew up as a Reformed Jew in Connecticut, and, you know, kind of hearing this record, some of the songs, while he takes some liberties with the melodies, I am familiar with some of the verses, so I thought that was fascinating. And the fact that it's sung in Hebrew should not be a turnoff, just because the whole thing is very melodic. And, you know, he sings in very close to the mic. Everything is very closely mic'd and well picked. If you have any interest in his past albums or just want to hear a very good acoustic singer-songwriter record, this will do the trick nicely. So I would highly recommend that. Let's listen to actually the one song on the album that is sung in English. The song called Oh, You Who Sleep. It's actually, I think he did it as he dedicated it to David Berman, was another artist who kind of around the time of his untimely death was sort of trying to reconnect with his Judaism. I mean, that song almost reminds me of something like a Jason Molina, like Songs Ohio era. It's the one I keep coming back to the most. But let's listen to that, and this is a gorgeous record.
Oh, you who sleep in childish folly's lap, childishness is chaff to be thrown off a week. Dark hair days don't endure, go out and meet the messengers. fading you in gray, with lessons every dawn. And shake off time, as birds shake off the dew of night.
All right, I too have been listening a lot to that Salzburg record, Psalms. I first heard Nathan Salzburg on his late 2020 album, Landwork Number 2.
Awesome record.
Where in which he built compositions around samples from 78 RPM phonograph records, a Yiddish folk song and a song by Slovak miners in northeastern Pennsylvania. The dude just examines kind of Eastern European in Americana history in such a fascinating way that I just can't get enough of. And I'm really into it. I highly recommend that record as well. I didn't have to think very hard about this album that I was going to recommend this week. It is incredibly Brian Core. For listeners of Osiris,
does it have ambient podcasts, pedal steel?
Such as there is no ambient pedal steel.
Well, it's not Brian Core.
It is instead. I think you will see this here in a second. It is instead a record that was performed on a 132-year-old pipe organ that examines sound along extended chords that are held over extended periods in time to hear the sound that the pipe organ emits while it's holding notes slowly but surely as it marches through the song.
Oh, geez.
This is Lawrence English's observation of breath. I am so into this record. I've had it on constantly. You can literally like feel the vibrations of this record in your bones. It's fascinating. Lawrence English is a Australian sound artist. The idea of this record is let's hold sounds on a 132-year-old pipe organ, throw the volume up as loud as possible, and see what happens when the rumbling comes through your system. So this was a record that English made during lockdown. He played at this organ in his hometown of Brisbane, Australia, just feeding air until the walls shook. It's a really, really fascinating record. It kind of taps into sonic elements like Tim Hecker, who's one of my favorite ambient artists. And it's just the kind of record that like I needed at this point in time. I throw it on. It's great in the background. It's really wild in the car. It's great in my headphones. It's really great at night when I'm reading. It's one of those kind of records that part of the reason I love ambient music is that you can live in it. Brian Eno, probably top 3, 4, 5 favorite artists of my entire life, once said that ambient music should be like wallpaper. It should just exist, but it should add texture and it should add insight to the room that you are living in that current moment. And this record, Observation of Breath, does that entirely. So for a very Brian Core record, we are going to listen to a bit off of Lawrence English's Observation of Breath, the song And a Twist, which is probably the most accessible song in the record and thus probably a good entry point here for listeners. Thank you. classic albums from 1966. What a year, man. Like, you throw out 1966, a lot of people think of 1967 as like the start of the hippie movement, the summer of love, San Francisco was aflame. For me, give me every single 1966 record where artists are wearing like brown and green sport coats and like scarves and like, you know, corduroy pants, and they're all smoking way too much weed and starting to take LSD and dabbling in Indian mysticism. I mean, there's so much in 1966 that I absolutely love, and there was so much to mine. One of my favorite records of all time is from 1966. This was just like a fun year to explore and to think about, like, how do we want to represent 1966? I'm going to throw it to you first. What did you select for 1966, and why did you take my record?
Well, I took your record because I think I need to prove to Dropland that you're not the only one who can talk about Bob Dylan on this podcast.
It's a fair point.
Wow. So 1966, Bob Dylan put out Blonde on Blonde, and to quote Jack Black's pushy record store clerk at High Fidelity, "You don't own Blonde on fucking Blonde? What's wrong with you? Don't tell anybody. It's going to be okay." My God. Look, I think in the span of about 2 years, Bob Dylan put out Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61 Revisited, Blonde on Blonde, and John Wesley Harding. 1965 and 1966 for Bob Dylan, if I make a baseball reference, that was like Tim Lincecum in 2008 and 2009. Just having years that nobody in history should be able to be that good for that period of time. It's just astounding the quality of stuff that was coming out of Bob Dylan in the mid-1960s. I mean, it almost, covering a record like Blonde on Blonde, it almost seems just like a layup. It's almost too obvious to even bother doing. But let this just serve as a reminder. It's one of those records you're like, wait, that's on there? That's on, that's holy shit. All of these songs are on that record. I mean, when you think of like, Jesus, Visions of Johanna, Stuck Inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again, I Want You, Just Like a Woman, Sad Eyed Lady to Lowlands, they're all on that album. That there's no way that anybody should be able to mine that level of inspiration in one record. It just, I revisited it yesterday for the first time in quite a while, and it still just throws me on the floor every time. This was a record he recorded with the Hawks that obviously went on to become the band, so you get a lot of like Robbie Robertson's guitar on it. But I was having a discussion. I have a Grateful Dead Club Slack that Brian's not a part of. Maybe he should be, but this is with some other 40-something dads talking about the Dead, and we just got through talking about how in 1995, Jerry Garcia did the most incredible covers of Visions of Johanna, and we said, like, was he able to nail every verse in Visions of Johanna, especially in the incredible February 21st, 1995 show from Utah, which you can find in any that's been officially released in any number of places. And I guess my friend Conrad was saying that the Dead used teleprompters in 1995, but they had them off for, like, U.S. Blues, which is how Jerry could, like, forget the lyrics to Dead songs he's played 800 times. But they always use them for the Bob Dylan covers, which is how he nails, like, every one of 800 verses in, like, Visions of Johanna, but could fuck up, like, U.S. Blues. But just Visions of Johanna could be my favorite Dylan song of all time. I'm not as big a Dylan head as like Brian is, but I had to make much more of an effort with 80s Dylan. That's going to be my goal going forward. But if for some reason you're listening to this podcast and you haven't heard Blonde on Blonde, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Let's listen to, why not Four Time Around? Let's listen to that. I didn't mention that song.
Great, great song.
It's an amazing song. Every song is.
When she said, "Don't waste your words, they're just lies," I cried, she was deaf. Hey, she worked on my face until breaking my eyes. got left. It was then that I got up to leave, but she said, don't forget. Everybody must give something back for something they get. I stood there and hummed. I tapped on her drum. I asked her how come.
All right. Yeah, it's funny. So we start planning this doc kind of early in the week before we record so that we kind of can add to it like new stories, what's happening in baseball, any new records that we want to cut. And before Dave shipped this to me, he included that he was going to cover Blonde on Blonde. So I was like, okay, I need to find another record because, you know, it's my second favorite Dylan release of all time. It's my favorite Dylan studio album of all time. And you nailed it. All the reasons for it. It's just a monumental achievement for an artist who is at an absolute peak. And I'm glad you went with Fourth Time Around because that is one of the deeply underrated cuts on the record. Sonically is just gorgeous. And like, it sounds like early morning kind of creaking into someone's a lover's apartment in Midtown or in like the Lower East Side of New York. It just there's so many elements of that song that add to the wide web of that record. I was thinking about what I want to cover here in 66. I mean, 66, like I said, it's got two of my favorite records of all time, two of the best records of all time in Revolver and Pet Sounds. It's got the Rolling Stones, Aftermath. It's got like the 13th Floor Elevators, Psychedelic Sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators, the Kinks, Face to Face.
Almost did 13th Floor Elevators. Almost. That was my second pick.
Great, great record. Got to the Mothers of Inventions, Freak Out. I'm just looking through it. The Who, a quick one. You got a Sun Ra and his Solar Orchestra, the Magic City. I mean, it's just an amazing year in music. And ultimately, I decided on one of the enduring trends. And one of the things I absolutely love about the late 1960s is the emergence of garage rock. And you hear this in Europe and you hear it here in America. And there's a record, self-titled record by a band called The Seeds that is kind of one of the enigmatic records of the time. This band is from Los Angeles, and their debut record, the self-titled The Seeds, was released in April 1966. You know, this record is just like, it was influenced by Mick Jagger's singing. It was influenced by Buddy Holly. It feels like this emergence for the first time in a lot of cases of rockabilly of the 1960s with the distortion pedal and guys in their garage just saying, let's plug in and play. And that idea, that simple idea, would go on to define so much of rock music over the next 40, 50, 60 years. We're still in it in a certain degree. When you look at indie rock and you look at bedroom pop and you look at the idea of just, I want to play music, I don't know where to play music, I'm going to approach it with a sort of DIY sound, and I'm going to end up on the other side wherever it may be. So many bands have gone under the wayside as a result of this and have just been heard by dozens, if not, you know, hundreds of people. But a small percentage of bands have helped to redefine rock music. And this record by The Seeds is one of those records that kind of redefines rock music. You can draw a line here between this, the Velvet Underground, punk, the Ramones, bands like Television, indie rock, Pavement, the Strokes, you know, so many bands that we've listened to over the last 60 years. So it's a fantastic record that sounds strangely modern. It's like one of those sounds that hasn't evolved significantly. Like you think about that, the Strokes record, Is This It, which is just like a classic update on New York garage rock, New York punk rock. Sounds modern, but also sounds in some ways like with a little bit more crinkle, it could have come out in 1966 itself. And there's just like something to this sound that is so contagious. I've listened to it a bunch of times over the last couple of days as we've been prepping for this episode. And I am excited for anyone out there who has not heard this, because it's the kind of record that you listen to and you're like, oh man, this is rock music. So we're going to play one of these singles here, Pushing Too Hard. It's a great just entry point into The Seeds by The Seeds.
You're pushing too hard, you're pushing on me. You're pushing too hard, what you want me to be.
All right, everybody. If you've hung with us for this long, thank you. We appreciate it. I think it was a fun ep. Covered a lot of ground. Got to hear that excellent interview with Daniel Donato. He's a bright young man. I really suggest you check all of his stuff out. Got to talk some baseball. Got to talk LCD Sound System. Got to talk classic Dylan records. We kind of did it all in this episode of The Drop. So, as always, we ask you to come back next week. We'll hold hands. We'll sing Kumbaya. We'll have a much better idea of where our baseball teams stand at that point. We'll all be together for The Drop.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11. Oh.